you, but I'm excited to be here tonight. We are asking one of the most important questions that mankind can ask, and a question that ultimately has immense implications for our lives and immense implications for the world itself. Today's a good day. Today's the first day of the week. It's the first day of November. It's the first day of daylight savings time. And if you're in corporate world of America, it's the first day of Christmas. So Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and Happy Thanksgiving, everything together. But in all seriousness, what we're asking tonight is a very serious question. I'm so glad you're here. And what I ask from you this evening is, first of all, for the first few minutes, take out a Bible with me. There should be a Bible for you in the pew in front of you. And go ahead and be opening up to the book of Ecclesiastes. The beginning of the Bible should have a table of contents. And we're going to Ecclesiastes, a really fun word, right? Ecclesiastes. Now, as Mike already told us this evening, Mike is one of our evangelists here and a close friend as well. The question we're seeking to answer this evening is, does God exist? Does God exist? Now, I will tell you all my history of this question. I was raised in a household with two parents who both believed in God. My mom was a believer in God. My father was a believer in God. Both of my grandmothers were. Both of my grandfathers were. All my aunts, all my uncles, all my cousins, everybody believed in God. But whenever I was an undergraduate in college, I began to read some of the deeper philosophers of history and began to ask questions I just couldn't answer. I didn't know the answer to. I began to ask questions that scared me, and I began to ask questions that I recognized made me realize my belief in God in many ways wasn't very substantial. I kind of always accepted it. Like, I kind of knew it was right. But then whenever I really sought to investigate why, I really didn't know. So what we're going to do this evening is take a journey. We're going to take a journey kind of into my mind of how I arrived at belief in God. And I hope we take a journey together. We're going to journey into this question. We're going to try to start at the beginning and ask the very foundational questions that are involved in this question. Does God exist? And then we're going to try to seek more application from it. So here's what we're going to do this evening. As I said, there is no more important question that we can ask. None. Even above asking what my purpose is, even above asking what my job should be, even asking who I should marry, even above asking any other question we can ask, there is no question more foundational than asking, does God believe? So here's how we're going to answer it. We're first going to go to the book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to draw a few points from that. Now let me say at the beginning, I recognize you may not take the Bible as the Word of God. You may take it as a book of men that really isn't inspired and that just is ancient. If so, I ask you to be patient. We're going to try to draw some philosophical points from this book. We're not going to presuppose God exists, and we're certainly not going to presuppose the Bible's God's Word, even though I do believe both of those things. But we're going to try to seek to investigate some philosophical aspects of Ecclesiastes. And then we're going to go into the concept of a worldview. So let's begin in Ecclesiastes. The book of Ecclesiastes is the most philosophical book of the entire Bible. The theme of the book of Ecclesiastes is the preacher's search for wisdom. Now, we don't know exactly who the preacher is. There are some guesses of who it is. Peter, do I need to go down just a little bit, or are we good? We're good? I'm loud, y'all, so you'll just have to bear with me. We don't know exactly who the preacher is. Many think he's Solomon. But what we know from the book of Ecclesiastes is that the preacher lived a long, full life. He investigated all that life had to offer. And at the end of his life, he thinks back in retrospect about his life and ultimately tries to get at the question of what the meaning of life is. So let's begin in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 1. Chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. What does man gain by the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been done is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new. It has already been in the ages before. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. So what the preacher claims in these few verses is there's nothing new under the sun. He's an old man who looks back on life and comes to recognize nothing's new. And he looks at all the different aspects of human existence and comes to recognize everything is repeated, nothing is new. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The sun rises and the sun goes down. The wind blows and around it goes. And on the circuits the wind returns. To the place where the stream flows, there they flow again. All throughout, there's nothing new under the sun. And when we look at just the habitual nature of life, I think these verses resonate deeply with us. American life can be very mundane, very habitual. We wake up, snooze through our alarm six times, go to work, eat lunch, go to the afternoon work, come home, take a short nap, sometimes a long nap, watch a little TV, spend some time with friends, go to bed. Then we wake up, hit our alarm 3 to 4 times, go to work, have lunch, go to afternoon work, come home, take a nap, watch TV, spend time with friends. Then we go to bed, wake up, hit our alarm, lie over and over and over. There's nothing new in life. And what the preacher says in these verses resonates very truly with us. Life goes on and on and on and on and on and on. And nothing's new. If this is our view of life, and this is what we feel of life, now this is a pretty sorry, boring life. And the preacher tries to find meaning out of this. How do we find meaning in the mundane? How do we find purpose in the ordinary? How do we find a reason for living in the midst of life? Go on to verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but striving after wind. For in much wisdom is in much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. What the preacher says is, there's sorrow in the search. If I could say more 21st century terms, the preacher has a midlife crisis. You know, he looks at the mundaneness of life. He looks at how just life goes on and on and repeats itself. And he looks and tries to see, what's the reason for living? Where is their wisdom? Where is their knowledge? Where is their purpose? If the world just goes on and repeats, how do I find this purpose? How do I find a reason for living? So the preacher has this midlife crisis, or more like a long life crisis, and he searches. And he says here, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity in a striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. It's sorrowful. And y'all, this resonates with me deeply. When I was an undergraduate of 20 years old, and I began to ask my question, what is my reason for being on this earth? I had been raised in a house that had taught me, serve God. But then when I became to recognize, I really didn't know why God existed. I really wasn't confident in that belief. It was sorrow. It was miserable. It was agony. I didn't know why I was here. I didn't know what my purpose was living was. I tried to find it in the Bible, tried to find it in philosophy, tried to find it in science, tried to find it in theory, and I looked and looked and looked, and it's a sorrow for search. But what do we do with this sorrow? Chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under the sun during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great many possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines in the delights of the Son of Man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. All my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward in my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and all the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained after the sun. I'm going to stop here. The main point he's making is there's vanity in this search. What the preacher recognizes is, I don't know where wisdom is. I've searched for it, and I just don't know where it is. And there was sorrow in that search. So he gets so sorrowful, he gets so disappointed, he gets so down, he distracts himself. So that he doesn't have to ask the deep questions, so that he doesn't have to have this sorrow over why I'm here, so that he doesn't have to have the torment in his mind when he lays down at night, what is the purpose of my existence? He distracts himself. And he does more than most of us will ever do in this life. He builds and he builds. He experiments. He gets hobbies. And after he does all these things, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Y'all, this resonates with me as well. When the search for purpose, when the search for God became so sorrowful, I began to distract myself. I didn't like the sorrow that came with the deep questions. I didn't like the torment that came that asking for meaning. So I distracted myself. I got involved in clubs. I got involved in organizations. Got involved in politics. Got involved in everything this life has to offer for an undergraduate. And you know what? All was vanity and striving after the wind. The clubs that I did so much to build up, I don't enjoy that anymore. The teams that I put so much effort into, yeah, okay. The awards that I put so much effort into getting, they're in a box somewhere. It's all vanity. And if the preacher finds sorrow in the search and he finds vanity in distractions, what then does he conclude? Verse 12. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that in the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen also to me. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been forgotten, how the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life. Because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. Now, y'all, let me ask you a very personal question. Have you ever hated life? I mean, I'm not talking about hitting the snooze button four or five times. I'm not talking about dreading going to work. I'm talking about hating life. What's the purpose of working? I mean, so what? We work 40, 50 years, draw retirement if we're lucky to live that long. move down to Florida, become a snowbird, golf the rest of our lives, so what? It's vanity. Who's going to enjoy my golf scores? Who after me is going to actually enjoy that? You know, I may get a little pleasure in it, but that pleasure passes. The hobbies that I invest myself so much into, they pass. When I was in high school, I had a teacher that taught us how to do origami. And I got pretty good at it. It's very mathematical, and I really liked it. Y'all want to know where my origami is now? In the trash, in a dump yard, somewhere where I never want to go. It's vanity. I haven't folded a piece of paper except in 2 years. It all passes. The hobbies that we get so into, the distractions that we put our lives into, the stuff of this world that consumes us, it's all vanity and striving after the wind. So what then? There's sorrow in the search. There's vanity in life. We don't enjoy anything that our hand finds to do. What then do we do? Well, there's two options. Beginning in verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he who will master of all, for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun, this also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who will not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What is a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. But there is nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. There's two views of life. In verses 18 through 23, the overall view of life is that toil leads to sorrow. Our work leads to sorrow. Our search for wisdom leads to vexation. Everything that we do, it leads to sorrow. Life and work have no purpose. I work and then it has no purpose. I distract myself and then it has no purpose. There's no purpose in any of the things I do under the sun. But, view two, toil leads to enjoyment. Do you notice the sharp contrast in verse 24? Up to this point in the book's very negative. It's very lacking of hope. It's lacking of joy. It's lacking of anything positive. But, verse 24, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Where does this enjoyment come from? I thought the preacher had vexation. I thought he had sorrow. I thought he was depressed. This also I saw is from the hand of God. What is the difference? Toil leads to sorrow when there's no ultimate purpose behind it. Toil and working lead to enjoyment when our purpose comes from God. And this is what the preacher recognizes. I work, I distract myself, for what ultimate reason? I die and become dirt, and that's it. That's a miserable view of life. But, if I know my work, if I know my pleasure, if I know everything that I do in life is from the hand of God, that is the only time in my life when I can find true enjoyment. We find ourselves happiest in life, not when we're distracted. We find ourselves most gratified in life, not when we are most given into the distractions. We find ourselves happiest when we have purpose. We find ourselves happiest when we recognize the purpose and the toil and everything comes from the hand of God. Now let's go into philosophy. This leads us to the concept of a worldview. Very simply and bold, a worldview is a set of assumptions about the basic makeup of the world. Expressed in a bit more simpler way, A worldview is the assumptions through which we perceive the world. Let me illustrate this. We don't know the exact origin of this story, but I think it's interesting. A son goes to his dad and he says, "Dad, what holds up the world?" The son had been looking at a map and it was a natural question. What holds up the world? Well, the dad, he of course knew it was a childish question, so he gave a childish answer. He said, "Well, son, it's a camel. The camel holds up the world." Well, you know, the child, he had seen camels hold things up before, so it made sense. But then the next day he thought, "Well, Dad, what holds up the camel?" So again, the dad said, "Oh, it's a kangaroo. A kangaroo holds up the camel, which holds up the world." But then the son thought about it a little bit more. "Dad, what holds up the kangaroo?" "An elephant holds up the kangaroo." "Well, Dad, what holds up the elephant?" The dad recognized where this was going, and so he answered, "You know what, son? It's an elephant all the way down." That's a worldview. It's what in our life goes all the way down. That is what we view everything from. There is a belief in our life through which we view everything. There is a part of our life through which we understand everything else. That's the elephant that goes all the way down. Now, I think all of us here would recognize that the earth is not held up by a camel, on a kangaroo, on an elephant. That'd be pretty cool, but that's just not the way it is. We recognize from a more scientific point of view, Dad, what holds up the world? Well, gravity. Gravity holds up the world. So then, you know, the child goes back and he says, "Well, Dad, why is there gravity? You know, why does gravity work?" "Well, son, gravity works because the universe is uniform and can be understood through scientific theories and laws." "Well, Dad, why are there scientific theories and laws?" And this is where we can take one of two paths. The uniformity of the universe, the laws of science, the things that hold up our world, the things that hold up our lives can be explained through one of two ways. We can either say God gives the world uniformity, God gives the universe sameness, God gives the universe the repetition and the replicability, or we can say it's just the way it is. It's in the universe. This brings us to the two overarching worldviews, theism versus naturalism. The difference between these two worldviews rests on how they view uniformity. On the one hand, the naturalists, to the naturalist, uniformity comes from the universe itself. Carl Sagan, a very prominent evolutionist, said, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be." So why is the universe uniform? The problem with this philosophically is it leads to infinite regress. Now let me explain what this means philosophically. Infinite regress is pretty much circular reasoning. You know A because of A. You know A because of A, and you know B because of B, and you know C because of C. You explain one thing from the other. I'm a huge Andy Griffith fan. And there's an episode of Andy Griffith where he's trying to sort out a feud between two families. And so Andy says, "Why are you feuding with them?" "Well, because he's a Smith." I don't remember the last name. "But why are you fighting with the Smiths?" "Because we're feuding." "But why are you feuding?" "Because we're a Smith." "But why is this?" "Because we're feuding." He explained these two things. He had no ultimate reason. And this is what infinite regress is. Why is the universe uniform? Because it's the universe. But why does the universe have this quality? Because it's uniform. The laws of science have been taken from the universe itself. The law of gravity is taken from just observations of the universe. We know the law of gravity by looking at the universe. And we know the universe has gravity by looking at its uniformity. These two things lead to infinite regress. But to the theist, uniformity comes from God. Go with me to the book of Colossians in the New Testament. Colossians chapter 1. Colossians is a letter, and it explains to us, to the theist, what holds up the world. Colossians 1 verse 16. "For by Christ all things were created, and in Him and on earth, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him. And in him, all things hold together. To the theist, it's not infinite regress. There's a supernatural personality who has given uniformity and predictability to the universe. Why is the universe uniform? Because God made it that way. Why does gravity work? Because God made it that way. Why do we have laws of nature? Because God made those laws. The difference between naturalism and theism is the source of the uniformity. To the naturalist, uniformity comes from the universe itself, and the universe gives back the uniformity. The theist doesn't have the problem of infinite regress, because we recognize there is a supernatural personality who has given this uniformity to the universe. To the theist, there's a purpose to the universe, but to the naturalist, uniformity is by chance. Going back to what the preacher says in Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verse 1, all the way down to chapter 2, verse 23, that's a view of naturalism. There's no purpose to life. There's no purpose to our toil. There's no purpose to anything that we do. We just live under the sun. We just live in the universe. But to the theist, our purpose comes from God. Our purpose isn't found in material objects. Our purpose is found in the Creator who made us. But let me ask this question then. Why do I really believe in theism? I mean, if you're like me, it's not just because of the logical validity of uniformity from theism. But I would argue there are things that only a theistic worldview can explain. If the universe is all that there is, and all that's ever was, and all that will ever be, then all we are is matter. All we all is stuff. And I would argue there are certain things that only a supernatural God can explain. Some examples. The first cause. The cosmological argument. The Kalam argument. The way the universe began. Everything has to have a beginning. The only way that the universe could have a beginning is if someone gave it a beginning. To the naturalist, the universe is eternal. Which one makes more sense? For us to have a beginning given by God, or for the universe to be eternal? What about morality? If there's no purpose to life, there's no morality. The only way that we can have moral standards, and the only way that we can have a true moral code, is if it's given by our Creator. Morality cannot be derived from matter. An abstract object like morality cannot be ascertained from just the uniformity of the universe. It has to come from a supernatural God. What about rationality? If we only have a brain, where does the mind come from? If all the brain is neurons working together, where then does the mind come from? Where does logic come from? Where does rationality come from? What about truth? Transcendent, ultimate truth. Truth has to be in a mind. Truth has to exist in a mind greater than ours. It has to exist in the mind of a supernatural God. What about love? If all that we are is a biological response to our environment, where does love come from? It's given by a supernatural God. What about beauty? I asked one of my friends here, he's a photographer, when do you most believe in God? I mean, what draws you closer? When I see the beauty in a sunset. That's not just a bunch of matter that we see. There's something supernatural almost about the beauty. It's not just an equation that we can just get at. But there's something greater than it. What about ultimate justice? Meaning in life? Human nature? Emotions? Evil? Free will? Human anatomy? I'll stop at this one briefly. I asked another one of my friends here, why do you believe in God? And he explained to me that he's a pharmacist and knows anatomy far better than I do. It comes from all the different human systems. human systems have to work together to make the body function. The only way that we could have all of these thousands of systems working at the same time is if there's a creator who designed them to work at the same time. What about physics? That's another one of my friends here. Why do you believe in God? He's a physicist. He explained to me one example, Coulomb's constant. I don't know if I said that right. But essentially, he explained to me, without this constant, atoms wouldn't work. And if atoms wouldn't work, nothing else in the universe would work. Physics is so precise, it's mathematical in nature. And that precision was created by a God. What about communication? I'm a communication student. When you take everything that's involved in the communication process, that I can get a view of what's going on in your mind. Communication allows two minds to exchange information. It comes from someone supernatural. What about ultimately my life? Everything that's involved in life, everything that's involved under the sun, the most rational way from my conclusion to explain this is by looking at a supernatural God. A couple closing comments then. What are the effects of a worldview? First of all, let me ask the question, what about faith? Faith is not reserved for just the religious theist. Faith is involved in both of these worldviews. Either worldview requires faith. If we view trust, faith is trust. There's no scientific way to prove the eternality of the universe. There's no scientific way to prove the beginning point of the universe. It must be accepted on faith. Faith isn't blind, and faith is certainly not opposed to evidence, but faith is the trust in the things we can't see. Our worldview affects not the evidence, but how we see it. And true science acquires both observation and replication. The final point I would leave you with. Our worldview affects every aspect of our lives. If we accept the worldview of the preacher, that there's no purpose to life, that it's just stuff, we have no purpose, the universe has no purpose, it's all by chance. If we accept there's a God who makes the universe uniform, who gives us purpose, it affects the very nature of my life. Questions I would have you to ask. Why do you toil? Do you toil for purpose? To please God, the Creator? Or does your toil and your work without purpose? Is your distraction without purpose? What's your elephant? What goes all the way down? What is that belief that goes all the way down in your mind and goes all the way down within your cognitive structure? Why are you here? Are you here by chance? Or are you here by purpose? Answering the question we posed at the beginning, does God exist? On my journey of faith, my journey of philosophy, my journey to go know God, I came to the conclusion, yes. But God's existence is known only through the proper worldview. If I accept naturalism, and I accept that all that is the universe, and all that is what is seen, and all that is the empirical materiality of the world, then we'll never reach the conclusion of a God. God's existence is only known if our worldview allows us to know Him. So I thank you all so much for your kind attention. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do now. Hopefully you've had some questions that I have raised or perhaps are also related to things I've not discussed. I'm going to give you about a minute to jot down those questions. And then if you will, please pass those forward to the center aisles here, the center rows, whenever you're completed. And then we'll have a couple of the gentlemen come by in about a minute. So spend about a minute to write down some questions on that note card and then pass them forward here. And then we'll have one of the gentlemen come forward to collect those. So take about a minute, please, to do that. finishing your questions, let me explain what we're going to do in the next few minutes. Go and be passing those forward to the center aisles, please. And one of the men will come by to collect them. So just hold your hand out and wave and they'll see you. What we're going to do, though, is Mike has prepared some questions that he had about what was said and about some topics related to God's existence. And as they sort through and organize the questions for relevance, we'll then have Mike ask some of the questions.
Ryan, you touched on this just briefly in your talk, but for our first question, I want you to think about what is the meaning or purpose of life?
That's a great question. As I said at the beginning, this question is contingent on our belief in God. Whenever we look at ultimate purpose in life, the preacher tried to find meaning in wisdom, in philosophy, in distractions, in work. He never found it. The only way that he found purpose in life was in recognizing God's existence, and in his recognizing his worldview had to adapt to that. The preacher finishes the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 12, verse 13. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. If we accept a naturalistic worldview, the purpose of my life is whatever I want it to be. I can do whatever I want to do. I can find pleasure in whatever I want to find pleasure in. I'm not constrained by morality. I can do really whatever I want to do. My purpose is what I want it to be. But if there's a God who has given his creation a purpose, that purpose has to be found in him. And the preacher concluded the purpose of his life was fear God and keep his commandments.
Okay, thank you. This was not touched on in your talk, but very related. If God exists, why does he allow pain and suffering?
One of my favorite questions when it comes to God's existence. Let me give a context to this question. Peter Kreft is a philosophy professor up in New England. And I heard a lecture from him once where he explained at the end of every philosophy class, he has the theist take the role of the naturalist, and the naturalist take the role of the theist. And it happens every semester. What happens is, the naturalist get a really crummy explanation for God's existence, but those who believe in God, they come up with an excellent, excellent refutation of his existence. And every time it comes from the problem of evil. Now, to answer this question, I'm going to get a little philosophical, but I'm going to try to define my terms. When we look at the problem of evil, there's two overall approaches to the problem. There's the intellectual problem of evil, and there's the emotional problem of evil. The intellectual problem of evil claims that there's a logical contradiction between God's existence and evil in the world. Most philosophers now would recognize there's not logical validity to this claim. Because if God has any reason for allowing evil, then there is a logical concordance between God's existence and between the existence of evil. So it could be that God allows evil because in a world with maximum evil, the maximum amount of people will be brought to eternal salvation in him. It could be that God has allowed evil because he allows man free will. So from an intellectual, and I'll call it a deductive perspective, there's not a logical contradiction between God's existence and the existence of evil. But let's deal with the more difficult one, the emotional problem of evil. This is, I think, where we get people. This is a very personal question for me. Back in 2008, I lost a very, very, very close family member in a tragic car crash. He was 29 years old. He had just gotten engaged. He had just gotten his life figured out. Just gotten a job, and it was awful. There's no other word I can use, and I won't water it down. It was an awful time in my family's life. And a question that I asked myself over and over again, why did God allow this to happen to me? Why did God allow this to happen to my family? My family lost three family members within about 2 years of each other, two of which were very tragic. And y'all, that time of my life, that really plagued my mind more so than any philosophical claim against God's existence ever could. But now let's deal with it from a biblical perspective. First of all, from a naturalistic perspective, if there is no purpose, there's really no such true thing as suffering. And suffering has no purpose. If suffering I'm going to define it as internal turmoil and internal struggles, then there's really no ultimate purpose from it from a naturalistic perspective. I suffer, and that's it. So what was the purpose behind all the agony, all the sleepless nights, everything that we went through? Nothing. There's no ultimate purpose for it. It just happened by chance. By chance, the universe went in such a way that my cousin died, my grandfather died shortly before, and my grandmother died shortly after, and it was just by chance. But from a theistic perspective, we can give purpose to this suffering. In the Bible, there's many different reasons why God allows suffering, one of which is human sin. Many times in the Bible, God allows suffering because His creation sinned and rebelled against Him. There's other times that God allows suffering to teach people a spiritual lesson. There's other times that God allows suffering to bring people to Him. There's other times God allows suffering because He wants them to repent. Throughout the Bible, there's many different explanations and many different reasons behind this. And let me say, the Bible does not ignore this problem. If the Bible completely ignored this question, I would really honestly question the validity of the Bible from God. Because this is the most personal matter that God's creation goes through. But God in the Bible speaks to His creation and He addresses this problem. There's at least four of the 66 books in the Bible that deal with this problem. But really, I think to answer this question, we have to look to the cross. We have to look to the cross of Jesus. It tells us in the book of Hebrews chapter 5. It tells us in Hebrews chapter 5, beginning in verse 7. In the days of His flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to Him who was able to save Him from death. And He was heard because of His reverence. Although He was a son, He learned obedience through what He suffered. God Himself suffered from the Christian worldview. God Himself endured the problem of evil. God Himself endured the human suffering. And the only way that that suffering is turned into hope, the only way to find any level of hope, any level of rationality, any level of assurance in our suffering, it was by looking to the cross. That God Himself came down to the earth and suffered, and He Himself then turned that suffering into hope through the resurrection. So let me take everything together. Logically, there's not a problem. Emotionally, there can be. If we think that it's a probabilistic scenario, God's given many explanations in the Bible for suffering, and He Himself suffered. And I argue that the only way to really find purpose and the only way to find hope within suffering is from a theistic worldview.
Thank you, Ryan. There were a few here that were very similar to that question. Let me ask a variation on that.
Sure.
just to fill in some any gaps that might be from this question's perspective. If God exists, why does He not intervene in our lives today, like stopping people from doing evil or killing people?
That's an excellent question. When we look at, especially this question comes up in the murdering of thousands of innocent children. This question oftentimes comes up of, why does God allow so much evil? Why does He allow it? Two explanations. The first one I think we have to recognize is free will. God has allowed free will. Genesis 1:26 tells us that God created man in His own image. And a part of that image was free will, the ability to choose. According to naturalism, it's deterministic. This is a philosophy and a scientific perspective that claims that all that we do is react. According to determinism, there's a stimulus and a reaction. But that reaction is not given by individual choice. On the other hand, you have the philosophical voluntarism, which claims that we have free will. The theistic worldview takes a voluntaristic approach in recognizing that we ourselves have free will. Now, the purpose of this free will obviously can be given for man to choose either evil or for man to choose good. But the only way that God could allow there to be good is by also allowing for man to have evil. backing up from one other perspective, from a naturalistic perspective, how do we really call something good or bad? I mean, how do we have a moral code that classifies events and classifies systems and classifies behaviors as good or bad? The only way that that can come is from a naturalistic worldview. One other verse that I would bring up within this context is that oftentimes when we look at immediate suffering, we have to recognize there's a more eternal perspective. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17. For this light's momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. As we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are unseen. For the things that are transient, for the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. From a scriptural perspective, one of the reasons God allows evil is because it produces within mankind a longing for eternity, a longing for it. Now let me also recognize, when we're the victim of this, when we're the victim of wrongdoing, when we're the victim of sin, or when someone we know closely is, it becomes an emotional problem. It becomes an emotional problem in that we just can't understand why God would allow this to happen. But I would urge us to take a bigger worldview perspective. Go beyond the kangaroo. Go beyond the camel. Get to the elephant. From naturalism, suffering is just a deterministic reaction. From theism, God allows it to produce within mankind an eternal weight of glory. Either we accept that these wrongdoings have a purpose that God has allowed, or we accept that it's purposeless and there's no greater reason to it.
Okay. If you include the first cause argument for what created the world, what caused God?
Excellent question again. When we look at the cosmological argument, the cosmological argument essentially is the argument of first causes. This is a very common argument that was throughout Greek philosophy, throughout Roman philosophy. Aristotle, Plato had the first cause. Many of those take the iteration of the cosmological argument. So then, looking at what caused God, God by nature is uncaused. When we recognize that God himself is the one who is the creator, and we recognize that God himself is the one who did the creating, by definition, God could not be created. If God were created, there's something deeper. So essentially, if God were created and he's the kangaroo, there's something deeper that is God. There's something deeper that was uncreated. There has to be an eternal being. There has to be an eternal presence. There has to be an eternal one who created time, who created the first cause, and who created all these things to start into existence. So it's a definitional answer. It's a definitional answer. God, by definition, cannot be created, or he's simply not God.
If Christianity is true, why don't we see a strong element in the supernatural examples, miracles, dead rising, etc., as is claimed in the Bible?
Excellent question. Excellent question. When we look at supernatural events, first of all, I think we need to define what is supernatural. And this becomes a more difficult issue. When we try to define something as either a naturalistic occurrence or a supernatural occurrence, it's a bit more difficult to do. David Hume, for example, was a naturalistic philosopher, agnostic, atheist, he vacillated, who claimed that ultimately, looking at the things of this world, that there is no greater reason and there's no greater purpose to it. So everything from a Humean perspective and from a naturalistic perspective is naturalistic. So from a naturalistic perspective, there's no supernaturalistic. There's nothing supernatural. There's no miracles. There's no resurrection. Everything has to follow according to the laws of the universe. But from a supernatural perspective, it is things in which God has an immediate hand in directing. God, for example, it says in Ephesians 2, had an immediate hand in raising up Jesus. God had an immediate hand in the miracles. In Matthew 28, it tells us that as Christ sent out His apostles, it was by the Holy Spirit and by the Father and by the Son that they were doing these things. So why then don't we see these things today? It's because God has promised us that these things are no longer around. When we look at, for example, the book of Zechariah, I believe it is in chapter 13, talks about a time in which some of these events are coming. It was going to be a short time and a limited time in the New Testament era where some of these things were allowed. And the reason for these miracles and the reason for these supernatural events were to point people to God. That's what pointed people to God, was by the miracles. It established the authority of Jesus, and it showed people that Jesus was truly the Christ. Today, we don't need those miracles. We have the greatest miracle of all, the resurrection. The resurrection trumps anything that came before it. The resurrection, 1 Corinthians 15 tells us, is the basis of our entire Christian worldview. The resurrection and the historical facts surrounding it, we'll examine that more in 2 weeks. That for us establishes the supernatural argument that there are supernatural events. So ultimately, why don't we see supernatural events today? Because God does not see them as needed and as purposeful. The resurrection provided for us all the supernatural evidence that we needed for us to believe in God Himself.
This may fit a later presentation better, but I'll ask it now, and
sure,
you may make a brief comment. Do the claims you raised, which are better explained by theism, morality, the mind, etc., could these be equally well explained by another God in another religion?
Sure. The question that we pose this evening is there a God? And you'll notice I really didn't make any strong arguments for Jesus Christ, for the Holy Spirit, or for the Father. I believe that God is threefold, the Trinity, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. We didn't address that question tonight. In 2 weeks, we're really going to address this question a bit more. We're going to talk about, does God care? And we're going to recognize that this involves Jesus in many ways. So the basic purpose of tonight was really not to answer that question, but that is a question that we'll be looking at in more depth. And I'd urge you to come back to consider in a bit more depth. But all that we really established tonight was just the logical validity of the theistic worldview over the naturalistic worldview.
A statement, there is an equation, facts to explain sunset. So that statement is,
sure,
is made. The question is asked, is beauty proof? Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Absolutely, that's a great question. When I threw up all the different things on that one slide of all the reasons, I don't take those as inherent reasons to accept a theistic worldview over a naturalistic worldview. What I was trying to show in those slides was, when you look at the entire aspect of human life, the entirety of human life is explained better from a theistic worldview than from a naturalistic worldview. Now, when you look at something like beauty, can beauty be reduced to a scientific equation? Perhaps. So you take, for example, some of the proportion in human, trying to figure out whether humans are beautiful or ugly. There are certain equations that you can look at that really have to do with proportions to show that, yes, there are scientific reasons why certain people are more beautiful than others. But that doesn't invalidate that beauty is a recognized supernatural greater concept. What I was trying to prove and trying to explain a little bit with the sunset example was, when we see things like that, it reminds us that there's things about life that we just really can't explain. When you look at love, I'm not claiming that these are things that are opposed to evidence. Please don't take that. What I'm trying to say is, when you look at the entirety of human life, and you look at the entirety of beauty, and all the other abstract objects, philosophers would call them, the evidence for them is better explained by a theistic worldview than by a naturalistic worldview. If I can take that question a bit further, why does that equation make sense in all cases? I mean, why does mathematics even make sense? Because of God Himself created it. I mean, where did mathematics come from if the universe is all that is? I mean, 1 + 1 is always 2. Always. You can work a differential equation. Many times you're going to get the same answer. One right answer, I should say. You should get one right answer. You may get 12, but you need to learn. You should get one right answer. That one right answer, that one truth, it had to come from a truth giver, from a mind. The mind greater than the universe is the one who allowed things like mathematics and even things like equations to have validity.
And I hope for the one who wrote that, that I captured that and conveyed that question well. We're running out of time, and we have a few more questions to ask. Let me handle those as well. And if let me just say as well, if there were aspects of your question that you didn't feel were answered adequately, we want to Ryan will be glad to think about those with you some more. And if your question wasn't read aloud, we definitely want to take the time to read that as well. With our time, let me ask one final question. You've argued for the existence of God. So what? You know, what are the implications of this existence of God?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. Whenever we look at God's existence, as I said at the beginning, this is the most important question that we can ask. Every other question in life is contingent on this question. The meaning of our life, the meaning of our existence, the meaning of the universe, every other question that we ask is going to be contingent on our worldview. Now, why does it matter if God exists or not? Well, we're going to go into that a bit more next week. We're going to talk about, does God communicate to man, and how does he communicate to mankind? But I would ask y'all to think deeply. Why am I here? I mean, why am I here? If I, for example, am a grad student working on a PhD, why do I want to get a PhD? Well, so I can get a degree. Why do I want to get a degree? So I can get a job. Why do I want to get a job? To provide for my family. Why do I want to provide for my family? Because that's what I'm supposed to do. Anything that we do in life, we get down to an elephant. Every question we ask, I mean, why, for example, do I grade papers? The distraction of my life as a teacher. Well, I grade papers because I need to give my students grade, and I need to give my students a grade so that I can teach the class, and I need to teach the class so that I can get my stipend, and I need to get my stipend so that I can provide for my family, and I need to provide for my family because there's an elephant. We need to get at the elephant. I'm afraid that we as Americans have gotten so on the level of the camel, and perhaps oftentimes on the level of the kangaroo, we've forgotten to ask the most fundamental questions. We get so distracted. I'll speak for myself. I get so distracted. I get so busy. I get so just filled with life that I forget to ask the deep question. So that worldview, that elephant, that basic belief in theism or in naturalism, it has immense implications for our lives. It's going to affect how we act, how we live, how we think, how we treat others, how we view morality. Every other question is going to be contingent for it. If there's a God, then that God is going to have expectations of me. If there's not a God, there's no real purpose. The elephant itself is just the empirical, the physical, and there's no real greater purpose for it. So what we're going to investigate next week is, what is the purpose? What's in the elephant? What has the elephant told us needs to be the kangaroo? How does the elephant hold up the kangaroo and the camel in the world? So try to ask, what are the practical implications then of the elephant and of our worldview?
Thank you, Ryan. Thanks for the presentation, and thank you for taking the time to give some careful and considerate answers to the questions. And thank you all for being here. Really appreciate your interest. And thank you for taking the time to write some questions and think through some questions. If your question was not read, I apologize. We certainly want to answer all questions. I know it puts you on the spot if you now have to personally come up and ask a question, so we hate to do that. Some of these we may be able to layer into the next couple weeks, but we certainly want to take every question and give it an honest and careful answer. But again, thank you for being here. please come back next Sunday, November 8th, 6 o'clock. I'm going to ask the question, how does God communicate? I want to make sure I said that correctly. I want to ask and seek to answer the question, how does God communicate? So again, thank you very much, and we'll be dismissed for the evening.